Miami was a great liberal arts school. You either went business back then, because the business school even then was highly, highly regarded, or you went liberal arts. And I actually wanted to learn things in college that no one was ever going to teach me ever again.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Beyond High Street. David Schwab here. Today's guest is Tom Fox, the president of the San Jose Earthquakes in the MLS, also a fraternity brother, Beta, from Miami, with Rick Dudley, a previous Beyond High Street guest. That's fun. Tom may be our first political science public administration major on the pod. So, of course, he's the president of an MLS soccer team. Actually, it's a good conversation talking about how Miami set you up to learn to put you in a job that ultimately fits what you're trying to achieve in life. And he started in brand management for Quaker before hitting the world, Nike, NBA, Gatorade, Arsenal, Aston Villa, Tokyo, China, London, now San Jose again. Really, really enjoyed that conversation. Spans a lot from where soccer is now to the future and how the content in their programming is built in a disruptive model, which is in line with just how the viewing habits of people are changing and the next generation, certainly my kids. But his first job, working brand management for Captain Crunch. We start the conversation with Tom as he talks about when David Stern asked him to open the NBA's first office in Asia.
I'll always be grateful to David Stern. I mean, I've sort of adopted the philosophy that I saw him put into practice, which is, you know, if you give young people at early stages of their career an opportunity to succeed or fail, but if you put them in a situation that they may not think they're ready for, you really find out what somebody's all about. I've adopted that, and I give David all the credit in the world. I was 31 years old. I had been at the league less than a year, and I had been to Asia precisely once to work on some sponsorship decks for Rob Levine, who was out in the region already, and David asked me if I wanted to go. It was actually David and Rick asked me if I wanted to go run Asia Pacific and actually open an office, because Rob Levine had been working from his house. And I mean, it was fascinating, because here was, you know, the NBA and a guy like David and Rick Welts putting a lot of faith in me and sending me to this far part of the world at a time when I don't think anybody really quite knew what the opportunity was going to be. And I got there and was by myself. We had a secretary who had the checkbook and was doing the mail, and we worked out of a hotel room for the first couple of weeks, but eventually opened an office in Hong Kong, opened an office in Tokyo. And then from there, obviously they've opened two offices on the mainland, but I'd like to think we sort of planted the flag, so to speak. And it was amazing, because it was at a time when the NBA and basketball was resonating hugely with what was happening in China, the opening up, the adoption of sort of Western culture, and we hit it at a perfect time, because they're big basketball fans already, and the NBA was becoming becoming a real sensation in Asia at that point. So I loved it, loved the opportunity, and will always be grateful to David and Rick, and have adopted that management style a little bit myself.
It's amazing to think that. So you're saying that's early 90s, 93, 94. That's 25.
Yeah, 94,
yeah. Yeah, 25 years removed from where we are now, and to think what the impact of the NBA has in China or Asia. And you're over there working out of a hotel with a secretary, kickstarting this thing.
Thanks for reminding me how old I am. I like to think I can remember those days like they were yesterday. But I do look back sometimes and just marvel at it, because we moved from a hotel room to a temporary office space, and then we started making the first few hires that we made, and we were sort of all jammed into this little location until we could get our office up and running. And those were amazing, amazing days, because you've got four people jammed in a room that should hold two, and everybody's, you know, running down different leads and doing different parts of the business. There was just such an energy back then. We believed that this incredible phenomenon called the NBA was going to take off, and we were, you know, the few of us that were in the office at the time felt like we were really on the front of something interesting. That's a great feeling. It's tough to explain it or to find another opportunity like that. But we had a great time back in those days.
And I know we are going back a little bit on that, but what were, because it's interesting to me of where the NBA is now, what were like just almost a singular goal? If you're opening an office for the very first time, just the exposure of this league to this enormous population, or what were you guys trying to accomplish in those first couple of years?
You know, the question I was asked all the time when I was leaving Gatorade to go work at the NBA, I'll never forget, someone said to me, gosh, I didn't realize you played basketball. And I said, no, I'm going to work for the NBA in a business capacity. The question I was asked most often was, you know, what's the NBA doing? You know, they didn't get it. They're like, NBA in Asia, what are you doing? And I said, think about it this way. With the exception of what the teams do, which is opening the doors and selling tickets and playing the games, we're in the exact same business in Asia that we're in the United States. We sell television rights. We sell sponsorship. We have a licensing business. And someday we'll bring events here and we will open the doors and create sort of a, you know, a gated game attraction. So when you explain it to people that way, people thought, yeah, the NBA is not playing over here. That people were so focused on the, you know, the teams and what was happening. And I was explaining to people constantly that actually with the way media is being distributed around the world, with the way big sponsors are increasingly looking to international markets for growth, whether it's Gatorade, Coca-Cola at the time, Kellogg's, you know, airline partners, whoever, they were starting to look at Asia as a real viable market, and the NBA represented a conduit in there. And so the first goal was to solidify sort of the television presence, because if we could get on television and if we could get on free TV on the mainland, CCTV, we knew we had a platform that we could leverage for sponsors. But back in those days, we were getting rights fees from ESPN and Star Sports, who were you know, two premium pay platforms across Asia. And interestingly, because they were fighting each other, you know, we were able to get a deal with both of them and able to play them off of each other. We had local deals in Hong Kong with TVB, and we had deals in Singapore. We had deals in multiple countries around Asia that were generating money. We had a deal in Japan as well. And so we had some revenue, but really the area everybody was focused on was how can we create a meaningful platform for the game and for the league in China? And that's what we were really starting. And I think that's what they've achieved today.
That's interesting. All right. So before we go forward from there, let's go back before the NBA. And you were saying some work at Gatorade and you were at Quaker Oats, which was that job one coming out of Miami?
Yeah. So it's funny because it was a real brand management job, and I had never taken a marketing class at Miami. I just had this conversation with the daughter of a neighbor last night. I walked in and saw a box of Cap'n Crunch sitting up on top of the refrigerator, and I said, that was the first brand I ever worked on. I came out of Miami with a political science degree and got an interview at Quaker through, you know, I think the way most people were getting interviews back then, through, you know, connections and family friends, and was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And really, because I'd not taken a marketing class, didn't really understand what brand management was all about. But the more I learned about it, the more interested I got. So I interviewed with Quaker and started on the Cap'n Crunch brand in August of 85 after I graduated as a marketing associate. Quaker at the time had a program where they were hiring about 30 MBAs from sort of top business schools around the country, but they had a program called the Marketing Associate Program where they pulled in 3, 2, sometimes 1, sometimes 4 undergrads as a part of that class. And we affectionately referred to ourselves as the few, the proud, the uneducated, because we did not come to the table with an MBA like everybody else, but it was an incredible marketing training ground. You know, Quaker, that company was one of the finest companies run when Bill Smithberg was the chairman. It was, and even Bob Morrison when he was the chairman, it was an incredibly well-run company, and their training programs were phenomenal. And so even though I had a political science degree, had not studied marketing, I came in and was, you know, in the span of about 6 to 8 months, I think I was pretty well up to speed on consumer marketing at Quaker and was given a real opportunity there and loved it.
And why political science? Did you have aspirations in school for that, or just you were at Miami and you were learning different things?
That was it. I mean, Miami was a great liberal arts school. You either went business back then, because the business school even then was highly, highly regarded, or you went liberal arts. And I actually wanted to learn things in college that no one was ever going to teach me ever again. Mm. So I wanted to learn, you know, religion and English literature and philosophy. I mean, I wanted a chance to study things that I think, you know, just aren't part of a working job or the things that they'll teach you. And it's really what I found. I was able to go into Quaker and learn marketing by talking to people that had studied it undergrad at a B school, and do, you know, learn it by being on a brand. And that, to me, that's how I've always learned best. I don't learn best by reading something. I learn best by sort of sitting and talking it through and experiencing it. So I got really, really lucky, I admit that, but I was really glad that I could spend my time at Miami getting a liberal arts degree. You know, and I was public administration within political science, and a lot of the classes in there were about organizational design and management. They weren't completely devoid of any sort of underlying business principles, but I really did like the opportunity to take some of the other more liberal arts classes.
The last couple conversations I've had with people on the pod, they said something similar when I've asked about, was there a class or a professor? And you know, it stretches their memory a little bit, like yours or mine, because it's a few years ago. But everyone said, Miami gave you the chance to learn. It just gave you a chance to figure out yourself and prepare you for whatever that job actually may be.
Yeah, I wish I could remember his name, and I could go back and try to figure it out, but I haven't thought about it in 30 years. There was a guy who taught a bunch of the classes within the public administration discipline in the political science department. I want to say he was a Northeasterner, but I want to say he was from Boston. He was fantastic. You know, it was, you know, the first time I was exposed to, you know, Peter Drucker in organizational design was in his class, and there was something about the way he taught that just captivated me, because I'd started business and I switched, and he was the reason I switched. I went and sat with him and I said, you know, like, I'm really struggling here. I don't know if I want to stay business. And I almost just had his name on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, yes, like a lot of people there, I was able to connect with an advisor, with a professor, and got incredibly interested in, you know, the classes that were a part of my major, and really felt like I did learn a great deal because of him and because of the way Miami's philosophy, I think, was built.
So if we go back from college all the way to present day, now president of the San Jose Earthquakes and the MLS, it's interesting. Your resume, your LinkedIn resume, let's call it. I mean, you have tried it all. You've lived in Asia. You've done the London circuit. You've done brand, league, agency, sports marketing agency, and now team. Have each been, I don't want to call a ladder to get to where you are, or just different pieces of the puzzle, and now understanding as president of an MLS club all the different facets of it?
You know, it was purposeful early in my career when I left. You know, I worked on the Gatorade business back from 88 to 93 when sports marketing was just emerging as a discipline. And it was a purposeful move at that time to leave the brand side and go to the league, go to the NBA, so that I could really get a chance to understand how other sponsors were viewing the NBA and to get an opportunity to be inside a league at a time when it was growing. And so I did that very, very purposefully. Quite honestly, I went to New York in 93 to work in the partnership and the properties on the property side of the NBA, but in the partnerships team. And I worked for David Schreff, and we were, you know, I was working with Miller Beer. I managed Gatorade, and I think I managed Nestle Stouffer at that time. I mean, it was fascinating to learn how those businesses were looking at the NBA, because I'd only previously had a sort of a Gatorade viewpoint. Moving to Asia was just something that came along, and I was smart enough to say yes. And then jumping to Nike in Asia Pacific and then back to Nike here was an opportunity that came along because of the relationships I was able to build in Asia. And then moving back to Gatorade after Nike, I mean, they were less purposeful sort of after that, right up until about 2009, when I got a call from a headhunter for the Arsenal chief commercial officer job. And I had lived in London as a boy, 72 to 75, and my son was the same age that I was when we moved over, and it had been such a great experience for the family and so defining for all of us. I talked to Ivan Gazidis, who'd been hired as the chief exec, and went over and met him, and we instantly clicked, and I just thought, this is going to be great. I have, you know, a couple of kids that have traveled extensively already, but allowing them and having an opportunity to grow up in a different country, I think, is a cultural experience that I really enjoy, and I thought they would as well. And so when I took the Arsenal job, again, it was very purposeful. I was not a soccer guy at that point, and I had not yet ever worked on the team side, and I did think that was going to be a great thing for me to be able to do. And so I did that for 5 years and loved it and built a great team there. And when I jumped to Aston Villa, it really was a chance to go from being purely a commercial guy into a chief executive's job and manage the entirety of the business and the entirety of the club. And so the job I do here, quite frankly, is not that much different than what I was doing at Aston Villa. The businesses without the Premier League TV revenue are actually of similar size, which I think surprises a lot of people. But take away the money that, you know, 14 teams in the Premier League get from being part of the Premier League, and their underlying businesses of ticketing and sponsorship are about the same size as our team here. And so I came back to largely for family reasons. My daughter wanted to go to high school back in the U.S., and I was willing to accommodate it. But I look at it, in 2009, I went to the Premier League at a time when I think they needed a more commercial mindset. The big clubs needed someone that understood how to commercialize the game in that way. And now I come back to the U.S. at a time when the game has turned the corner. And my experience, I think, is exactly what this club in this market needs right now. So it's, some of it was purposeful, but other times in my career, it's just been letting the opportunities come and being smart enough to either say yes or say no. And I think that's the same with anybody. You've got to understand what an opportunity is in front of you, and sometimes just go with what's presented to you.
And now 10 years, as you said, when you started at Arsenal, you were not a soccer guy. Well, 10 years later, you certainly have to be a soccer guy.
I mean, yeah.
We're seeing it. My three kids are out there every day. You're right. And there's a change in the marketplace. And I know we mentioned it earlier before we even went on, just talking about content in the future and how kids are viewing and how soccer is set up for that maybe differently than other leagues. Your kind of take on where soccer is just positioned right now.
Yeah, you know, I followed, obviously, the men's and women's national team at Gatorade. We worked with Landon and Mia and Lil and Jules and Brandy and all. I mean, we had a relationship with the U.S. Soccer Federation, and my first boss in sports marketing at Gatorade, Hank Steinbrecher, had been the executive director of U.S. Soccer. So I was not a pure soccer fan. I knew the national team game. And when I went over to Arsenal, what I learned very quickly is those clubs over there are big global brands and had incredible opportunities to extend their business even further. But what I really started to appreciate was the game itself. I mean, I think, you know, I don't mean this sort of as a negative against other U.S. sports, but other U.S. sports are driven primarily by their media value, how many eyeballs, how big an audience, and therefore how much advertising revenue can you generate. And in fact, a lot of the American sports over time have grown the length of their game by adding more and more commercials in and taking TV timeouts and extending the time of the broadcast. And, you know, those leagues have seen huge and reaped huge financial benefit on the back of that as they've grown. The ironic thing right now, and what I saw when I started watching the game of soccer, is that, you know, it has no commercial breaks. It's got a running clock, and it lasts less than 2 hours. I mean, you can extend it on either side by coming into the broadcast earlier and doing a pregame and staying later and doing a postgame. But the game itself always lasts less than 2 hours, you know, and it might have, you know, 8 or 9 minute commercials that happen largely, you know, a bumper at the front, bumper at the back, and then during halftime. And what I started to realize was, you know, this was a league that wasn't relying on advertising revenue, even though obviously the Premier League generated huge television rights fees, it wasn't relying on advertising revenue. And as I started to watch the way viewing consumption was changing, I started to watch my own two teenage children. If I asked them today to sit in front of the TV for 3 hours and watch something that has, you know, 2 hours worth of commercials or an hour and a half's worth of commercials, it's not going to happen. They'll watch something on their phone, pad, television screen, whatever, for 3 hours, but that'll be a whole season of something. They won't sit through the commercials. And so I started to realize, I think soccer is a bit more future state from a media point of view. And this is the great irony that, you know, it used to be sort of the big negative, you know, soccer doesn't have commercials, you can't monetize it. And actually the whole economy of you know, television and advertising has sort of come around to a different place where what used to be our weakness is actually now our strength. And I really do wonder how the other leagues are going to react to how viewership is changing. And are they going to start shortening their broadcast. There seem to be two upstart American football leagues, you know, that are looking at changing the way those games are played and broadcast to shorten the time and to deal with some of the things that we're talking about right now. So I wasn't a soccer guy in 2009. I have very much grown to love the game, and I believe in it just, you know, as a fan, because I love watching it. I do think it's just pure sport for 2 hours. But I also think from a business perspective, the reason the game is turned a corner here, the reason sponsors like Adidas and Heineken are re-upping their deals, you know, for significant investments and greater investments that they made in the past, is because they see that the trend is our friend, and that soccer is here, and it's dealt with already. What a lot of these other leagues are going to have to deal with, which is how do you start to wean yourself off of advertising revenue?
Yeah, I thought I was waiting at this Olympics, because the Olympics is another one of those where there's the action doesn't stop. It's continuous, and I was surprised even in 2018 that there wasn't more of a split screen advertiser perspective and show figure skating on the left and don't miss somebody or come back halfway through and run the ads on the right. But you're right, there's a model that was set long time ago, and that's harder for a traditional sport and a network to change if that's what the expectation is from the advertiser too.
That's right, because everybody running any one of these businesses, whether you're a league or a team, or whether it's a brand in the general market, it's all about growth, right? It's all, okay, we had a great year. How are we going to lap it? How are we going to find growth? Where's the growth coming from? You talked earlier about how Octagon is growing sort of horizontally, right? There was a period of time when it was all about vertical. Now it's about broadening the range of services and growing your agency that way. But it's all about growth. That's what Rick Dudley's thinking about constantly. Where do we find the growth from? If you're in the sports business in the U.S., let's just say, for example, you're in the NFL. You're not a big international game because they don't play it really anywhere else. You've got, you know, okay, England. There might be a fertile market there, although I'm not so sure. I'm a big buyer of a team there, but you don't have a big international following, so your ability to grow internationally, I think, is possible, but it's certainly not going to be ever to the extent that the NBA sort of has captivated international markets. And you're saturated in the U.S., so how do you continue to find growth? Well, they've done it by taking the same size pie and slicing it into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces, you know, redefining media, taking advantage of the new social platforms, all these things. But at some point, sitting in front of a television for over 3 hours and watching something that has 2 hours worth of commercials is going to catch up to them. And I wonder, what's their pivot? What's their move? You know, because I we can all look back at businesses that were disrupted or disruptive themselves and then ultimately disrupted and, you know, and think someone's got to get out in front of that strategic imperative at that league. And I think the other leagues are going through it as well. It's a very interesting time in the sports landscape. And you're right, they're all addicted to that revenue. They're all looking for growth. It's going to be harder for them to achieve. I guess the only thing I'll mention, I mentioned it earlier in our conversation, was the Masters, because there is a brand that's got it right. Not only are they not addicted to huge numbers of advertisers, and not only do they not clutter the broadcast up and therefore create a completely different experience on television, because they've done that now in this environment, as everything pivots the other way, they're in a perfect situation. They don't have to do anything differently. And in today's landscape, I think they can continue to command the incredible premium they do for the brands that they choose to associate with. I think it's a really brilliant strategy. I mean, everybody talks less is more. They've lived it consistently, and it's a great broadcast to watch. I don't mind watching the Masters live on television. It takes a long, long time, but I'm not sitting there being asked to view tons and tons and tons of commercials. That's the difference, and I think this is a period of time in our industry that people are really going to have to get their heads around, because we're going to be making decisions now that are going to impact, you know, the industry for 5 and 10 years.
And speaking of disruption, excuse me, and content and the changing viewing, what's your take on esports and gaming and the impact that FIFA's had on soccer for you?
Well, great question, because we just came out of the MLS e-gaming tournament, and our guy Callie lost at the in the knockout rounds, but made it pretty far. Look, I think FIFA's been great for the sport of soccer. I think the fact that EA can tell you, you know, every single day how many people around the country are playing with a team that's branded Arsenal or Earthquakes, I think provides, you know, incredible data and demonstrates how important the game is globally, and they could tell you where it's happening and where the trends are. It's an amazing tool for data, but it also exposes kids around the world to MLS clubs, to our brands, to our players, obviously in a smaller way right now than the big European and other international teams. But I think it's great for us to be on that platform with those other leagues. I think it gives us a credibility that we're just now starting to really earn. I think e-gaming is fascinating. You know, I haven't watched a broadcast. I don't know the extent to which it's cluttered with commercials and other commercial imagery, but my son watches it on YouTube, and he watches it in small, you know, small short clips, and I think it's a great way to capture not only what kids are doing right now, which is gaming and spending a lot of time in that world and trying to put our brands in front of them in that way, but I think it's also, you know, a great way to try to capture an audience. There are people that are interested in watching. We should brand it. We should be a part of it. And I really applaud what the league is doing. I think 16, maybe more of the 23 teams are involved with a player. We're in there. And it's clearly early days, and it's an experiment. But I think it's here to stay.
Great conversation with Tom. My takeaway after listening to Tom for 25 minutes or having a conversation with him, besides of the unbelievable success he's had and growth across continents and industries, is back to what he said about Miami. Miami allows you to learn. It prepares you for whatever that job may be. I mean, again, he was political science, went into brand management, and then has worked his way up to the very top of sports business and sports marketing. He also touches on two things about taking some jobs that were calculated to put him in a position for the future, but also to take risks. Yes, it was a great opportunity that David Stern asked him to open the Asian office. He also had to say yes, get out of the comfort zone, but try something when you're younger. Really appreciate Tom taking a few minutes. Hope everyone has a good day, good rest of the week. Let's have a beer at Skipper's. See you soon.